to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
I mean, these people are crazy. This is the United States government. First of all, you never have to default because you print the money, I hate to tell you, okay? So there's never a default. But the point is, it was reported in the New York Times that I want to default on debt. You know, I'm the king of debt. I understand debt better than probably anybody. I know how to deal with debt so very well. I love debt, but you know, debt is tricky and it's dangerous, and you have to be careful and you have to know what you're doing.
That's the self-declared king of debt, Donald Trump, providing a stage for us this week to talk about how monetary policy and reform is emerging in this election year from the top of the national ticket to the bottom of the local ballots. Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a biweekly look into the world of money and monetary issues and the conversations that are emerging around how to deal with our so-called money problems and the ideas being thrown around as so-called money solutions. Hi, I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's co-host. This week we're going to touch down in several places, beginning with the Donald's shocking admission, for most people anyway, not our listeners, of course, that we can print the money we need and will not, cannot, default on our national debt. Imagine that. If the U.S. House of Representatives understood that our national debt represents the cash flowing in our economy, perhaps they'd feel obliged to drop their austerity cudgel and get on with investing in our country. But debt is just another name for the monetary racket that we all serve, and the king of debt has inadvertently given us an opening to discuss it today. Later on, we move down the electoral ticket to speak with two other candidates focusing on monetary reform in their campaigns. One is Dr. Tim Canova, who's running against prominent Democratic insider Debbie Wasserman Schultz in South Florida. Tim is a law professor, author, expert on the Federal Reserve, and a strong supporter of public banking, who thinks it's time to redo the laws about how the Federal Reserve is managed and directed. His campaign, sort of like Bernie Sanders, has surprised everyone with a remarkable outpouring of small donor contributions that's making him a real contender against the establishment interests. Ellen spoke with Tim Canova while on the campaign trail, and we'll get to that in a couple of minutes. Then we head west to Arizona and talk with a candidate who's running for a seat in the state house who feels public banking is urgently needed there to pull that state and its communities out of an economic decline driven in part by debts to Wall Street for public financing. We speak with Pamela Powers Hanley on her spirited campaign. And later on in the program, we'll turn to Wall Street itself in this week's edition of What Wall Street Costs America, PBI's national campaign to educate citizens about the financial and personal costs of continuing our unhealthy reliance on Wall Street finance. Matt Standard interviews noted reporter David Dayan about his latest book called Chain of Title, discussing how three Florida consumers took on Wall Street mortgage fraud and won. Say what you will about America's electoral landscape, and let's not get started on that, shall we? It's become a vibrant Democratic effort on the part of more and more unconventional characters who want to shake things up. So let's get started and talk with Ellen about Donald Trump's passing, but rather explosive admission, that our national debt really isn't the problem it's made out to be.
It's your thought that maybe Mr. Trump has taught the nation a rather great lesson this week, even though he's been abused and criticized for it on right and left, I guess, for what he has been saying about the federal debt.
Yes, so he created another firestorm, as he's kind of famous for doing. Last week, he said something to the effect that he would deal with the debt by making a deal, that, you know, you can negotiate these things, which was interpreted to mean that the creditors would take a haircut. They would that, in other words, we would default on a portion of the debt. And, of course, all the commentators said, no, this is the USA. We can't do that. It's irresponsible to even suggest that. But so then on Monday he said, of course, that's not what he meant. Of course, that would be a stupid idea. That what he actually meant was that if interest rates went up, then people do sell their debt for less. You know, interest rates going up makes let's say you have a 10-year bond. If you hold it for 10 years, you're going to get full value, of course. But a lot of people want to sell before the 10 years are up. And so if interest rates go up, then buyers can get 10-year bonds at a higher interest rate, so they're not going to be interested in those low interest rate bonds. So the people holding the low interest rate bonds have to sell them for less than they would get if they held it to maturity. So that's right. What he meant, that there are always those bonds for sale and that you can snatch those up at a discount and that the government could do that if you had the liquidity to do it. And then he said, I hate to tell you this, in like sort of typical Trump fashion, I hate to tell you this, but we print the money. You know, the U.S. government issues the dollars, and therefore we can print the money to buy the debt. So we've got the liquidity, basically. So this is what created another firestorm, and all the commentators said that was irresponsible. You can't print the money, that will cause inflation, and then that will dilute the value of the dollars, and the taxpayers wouldn't stand for it because they'd be paying more at the grocery store. But I've been arguing ever since I wrote Web of Debt in 2007 that that's what we should do, that you could buy up the debt just by issuing the money through the Federal Reserve or the Treasury, either one, and that it would not be inflationary. Basically, what you would be doing is turning the debt back into what it should have been in the first place, which is real money. In other words, we don't have any money in our system. Virtually the entire money supply is created as a debt. It's created as a debt by private banks. The only thing that's real money that's created, just issued by the government, is coins, which is a very small percentage of the money supply, extremely small. Even dollar bills are created by the Federal Reserve and lent or sold into the market. In other words, banks buy the dollars in order to satisfy their customers who want cash, but that they've got a reserve account, and then they buy it from the Fed. So it's not like the Federal Reserve just spends the money into the economy as the American colonists did very successfully. So it seems to me we should go back to that original model where we issued the money directly, and particularly, of course, the Pennsylvania model where a good portion of the money was lent into the economy through, you know, it was printed by the government and lent into the economy through a publicly owned bank so that the principal and interest came back to the government, and then they could use that interest that was income to the government, which means income to the people, which they could spend on government services. So let's say, theoretically, well, first of all, we already have bought. It's not like the idea of buying up the federal debt with money issued by the Federal Reserve is a new idea. We've already got $2.5 trillion worth of debt bought very recently through quantitative easing by the Federal Reserve. And not only did it not create the much feared double-digit inflation, it couldn't even reach their very modest inflation target of 2%. And that was the whole idea, to create inflation, but it didn't. Why? Because, well, for one reason, the money went to, you know, it just went to banks, went to big investors who then maybe bought stock in the stock market, so the stock market went up, but it didn't affect consumer prices.
So we never have to default, he says, because we print the money, and that was the statement that made everybody think that he was crazy.
I thought that was totally irresponsible and should be ignored because everybody knows that won't work because it'll create inflation. But I would say it won't create inflation. They've already done it with $2.5 trillion through the Federal Reserve, which didn't create inflation at all in terms of consumer prices, goods and services. And a third of the debt is held by Social Security and other trust funds, you know, Medicare and such. So that's like at least $600 trillion. The debt is $19 trillion plus. And then I guess if you count in what we're going to be short on the budget this year, it comes up to close to $21 trillion. So let's say at least $600 trillion is held by Social Security and other trust funds, Medicare and such. And so let's say the Federal Reserve bought that debt off of the trust funds, $600 trillion.
Did you say $600 trillion?
Oh, sorry, $6 trillion. $6 trillion was bought off of the trust funds. So you would have $8.5 trillion held by the Federal Reserve, which, of course, rebates the interest to the government. And then the Federal Reserve wouldn't have to claim that money. They can just keep rolling over the debt from year to year because they're the government. We are the government. So now that Social Security and Medicare and so forth would have $1 trillion in cash that they didn't have before. So what would they do with it? They don't spend, you know, the Social Security Administration does not spend on goods and services. They would reinvest the money, no doubt, if they could find some place to do it that would be very safe and secure. You know, they have to keep their investments liquid and secure, and that's why they buy federal securities. They might buy state and local government bonds, or they might buy corporate bonds if they're safe enough. I don't know exactly what they invest in. Or they might just hold it in cash. But they're not going to rush out and buy goods and services with it. That's not what they do. I mean, even ordinary bondholders are not going to rush out and spend the money just because it's been turned into cash. They're going to invest it in something else. So maybe it'll be loans, which we need more low-interest loans.
So going back to paying off the debt, of course, if you paid off the debt, we wouldn't have any money, right?
If you paid off the entire debt, spent all the circulating money supply to pay down debt, we would have zero money in the money supply, nothing to buy things with. And we would still be heavily in debt. So that's not the way to do it. The way to do it is to generate more money. We need more money in the system. The system is short of money. And the whole world is short of money just because all of our money is debt. We don't have a real money system. We have a debt system. And it's all about making money, and it's not about making real things, goods and services. Like, it makes no sense that we have Social Security, I mean, these trust funds that Treasury is paying interest to. Let's say the Federal Reserve bought those bonds off the trust funds, and the trust funds just left it in cash. Well, the trust funds would not be making the interest, but the Treasury would not be paying the interest, and they're the same entity. So what's the point of paying interest to yourself? You know, just pay the thing off with real money and let the money sit there, and when Social Security or Medicare needs it, then spend it in the ordinary way. Or ideally, I would say, just let the Treasury issue the money they need in the form of U.S. notes, like Lincoln did or like the American colonists did. But if that freaks everybody out, if everybody thinks that's inflationary, then let them borrow from the Federal Reserve as needed, as they just did to the tune of $2.5 trillion, and it didn't rock the boat at all.
Then you're saying that Donald Trump is right. We never have to default because we print the money. And that's
it won't cause inflation. And in fact, it would solve a lot of problems. I think that's what we should do.
So are there any other presidential candidates speaking in terms like this that has gotten your attention?
No, which, you know, one would hope that Bernie Sanders is open to monetary reform. But the thing about Donald Trump is that he shoots from the hip and just says it like he thinks. And so that's why it's just kind of neat that somebody blurted that out and said, I hate to tell you this, but... You know, we print the money. We can fix this problem.
Yeah, the king of debt. I love debt, he said.
Right. I know debt better than anyone else.
Well, let's see what Donald Trump says this week.
That is one of his strong suits. You know, why people like to watch him is he's entertaining, and he's, you know, he's always coming out with things.
This, I think, was a nice provocation, at least for our interest.
Yeah, and in the direction of monetary reform.
All right, we'll see what happens.
Okay.
Thanks, Ellen.
Hey, great talking to you. It is my great honor and pleasure to be speaking with Professor Tim Canova, who, among a very large list of accomplishments, is now a candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives challenging Debbie Wasserman Schultz in Florida. We've interviewed Tim several times before, and he did a very illuminating presentation at the Public Banking Institute conference in San Rafael in 2013. He is currently professor of law and public finance at Nova Southeastern University in Florida and has written dozens of articles and chapters in books, including in the Harvard Law Review and the Georgetown Law Review. He's also practiced law at Gibson, Dun & Crutcher in New York City, taught at a number of universities, served as legislative assistant to the late Senator Paul Tsongas, and served on an advisory committee put together by Senator Bernie Sanders on reforming the Fed. It's great to be speaking with you again, Tim.
Well, thanks, Ellen. Nice to be with you.
I heard you on a video clip saying that Bernie Sanders was your inspiration for running in this election, and it seems your campaign has really taken off. You've raised nearly $1 million without taking corporate money, following Bernie's lead, so that's great. Do you want to say a little bit about your campaign and how it's going?
Sure. It's going very well. We did raise $500 million in the first quarter, and in the 5 weeks since, we've raised almost another $500,000. I think we're going to pass the $1 million mark any day now. You mentioned that it was inspired in part by Bernie Sanders' run, and certainly we have a very common agenda, a progressive agenda, and the campaign is resonating here in South Florida as well.
Yeah, and the New Republic, speaking of you, says if elected this fall, he would instantly become the strongest advocate in Congress for a people fed. So that's what I would love to talk about. What are your proposals for how would we turn our current Federal Reserve into a people's Fed?
Well, you've probably heard a lot of this from me before, so it won't come as too much of a surprise to you. And I should say that my views on the Fed have not changed now that I've become a candidate. First thing, I think the Fed needs to be reformed in its governance structure. And you mentioned the advisory committee that I was on that Senator Sanders put together to advise on reforming the Fed. And that was probably the thing that the committee agreed on the most right off the start, was reforming the Fed's governance structure, essentially taking the selection of the regional Federal Reserve Bank presidents out of the hands of private bankers, you know, the private boards of directors that have been choosing these regional bank presidents. The thing is, when you take a look at the Fed's governing structure, it's dominated by big banks, and it's not surprising that its monetary policy is also geared towards supporting big banks. And really leaving everybody else behind. So you got to reform the governance first, but I think you also need to give the Fed the tools and the mandate to be approaching the economy much differently than it is. Instead of a trickle-down approach to monetary policy, there really needs to be a bottom-up kind of an approach. And we saw some of this in the Great Depression in the 1930s and 40s when the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks made loans directly to small businesses, and that's certainly one bottom-up approach. I've also advocated Fed pushing money into state infrastructure banks so that these infrastructure banks would not need to borrow from the bond markets. They should be able to get the same very low interest rates that the Fed regularly gives to Wall Street banks and hedge funds and foreign banks and foreign central banks.
Yeah, that's great. I just did a chat with Walt for this radio show where we talked about Donald Trump's coming out and saying that you could deal with the federal debt just by printing the money. He said that yesterday, which, of course, created a firestorm of opposition that this would create massive inflation and we couldn't do it that way. But I would disagree. I think that actually is the way it could be done. What do you think? What if the Federal Reserve, they've already bought $2.5 trillion worth of federal securities, and it didn't create inflation at all.
Oh, that's right.
So what would happen if they, like, gradually bought up the entire debt that way?
Well, you know, it would probably cause a price inflation in the Treasury market, right? It would push Treasury yields down. It would keep them very low. It would, you know, increase Treasury prices a lot. So aside from that kind of an inflation, I'm not sure it would create much else. As you alluded to, the Fed for much of the past decade now, really since the financial collapse, it engaged in what was called quantitative easing, in which through, three quantitative easing programs, it purchased $3 or $4 trillion worth of Treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities. And aside from pumping up Treasury prices and the prices of securities, I'm not sure it had much else of an effect on anything.
Yeah, so that's what I think. You would just be turning debt money into real money, which would be a good thing. And it doesn't really seem to make much sense to have, like, the biggest holder of federal debt is Social Security and Medicare, the trust funds. And so here they are lending to the federal government, which it's all one big government. So why not just issue the money directly instead of this sort of ruse of borrowing and paying interest to ourselves?
Well, and it's probably more resonates in people's minds with the other holders of treasuries, being People's Republic of China and Saudi Arabia and some other foreign states. And this came up recently. You know, there's talk about disclosing the secret chapter of the 911 Commission report that apparently points the finger at high-level Saudi officials for their involvement in the September 11th attacks. Who knows what the level of involvement was, but that's what this classified chapter would apparently reveal. And also a push to make Saudis perhaps liable in U.S. courts for acts of terrorism. And the Saudi regime responded with anger and said if this was going to happen, perhaps they would just sell off all the treasuries that they hold, and you know, probably $800 billion or more of treasuries. And, you know, this story was discussed as if this would be a catastrophe if the Saudis were to start selling off all these treasury holdings. And I think it would just be a catastrophe for the Saudis, not for anyone else. You know,
right.
the Fed could purchase those $800 billion of treasuries without missing a beat.
Yeah, or if they sell them on the open market, I mean, they just change hands. Somebody else buys them, but it's not like, I mean, we already got the money. We already borrowed the money and spent it, no doubt. So
right.
If it holds the bonds, doesn't really matter. Yeah, I agree.
Right.
And then if you could talk a little more about the New Deal and how things were funded in the 1930s. I just think that's such an inspiring story. I mean, we've done it before.
It really is, and I've written a bit about this. During the New Deal, they had the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was essentially a federal infrastructure bank. And it was started under Herbert Hoover, but Hoover used it somewhat sparingly. Under Hoover, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was really propping up big banks and insurance companies and big railroads. And in 1932, in the presidential election campaign, Franklin Roosevelt called this a trickle-down approach, and he said he would use the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to help essentially the Main Street economy. And he got elected in a landslide, and that's exactly what he did for the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. For the next couple of decades, it was helping finance infrastructure all over the country. Some of the major infrastructure projects that we take for granted, the massive bridges and seaports and tunnels and airports, were financed by the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. They also even subsidized school teacher salaries in Chicago and a bunch of other New Deal kinds of programs.
And they got the money by borrowing, though, right? They were borrowing from the Treasury. Where did the Treasury get the money? Did they just issue it? Or?
Well, you know, the Treasury was getting the money from the Federal Reserve at very low interest rates. The Fed was borrowing in the bond markets, but bond yield was pegged at very low rates for most of the period, yeah.
Yeah, and if you make that type of loan, which are all productive, like roads, bridges, farms, they're all actually, it's infrastructure, basically, so it actually returns more to the economy than what you put into it. I mean, pay it back with the proceeds of the thing you just built, plus
that's right.
You're generating jobs, and you're generating all the things that companies need in order to produce things and be productive.
Well, that's right. And as you generate jobs, you're putting tax-paying resources back to work. So it does pay for itself several times over, I'm sure, over the course of a couple of decades.
We should do that again. I agree. So is there anything else you'd like to talk about in your particular interest in your platform?
Sure. I'll say that I've been attacking my opponent, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, for taking millions of dollars from big banks and big corporations, whereas our campaign has been financing itself, has been raising money in small contributions. So our average contribution is less than $20, and we've had almost 50,000 donations now. So Wasserman Schultz takes money from these big banks, and you take a look at her voting record and what she's been doing, and one of the big issues that's been nagging her has been her support for payday lenders. And Florida has a payday lending law that essentially allows these lenders to get 300% interest rates and more over the course of these loans. And Wasserman Schultz is in the position of trying to defend this scheme and say that it's better than nothing. Otherwise, these borrowers would have to go to loan sharks. And of course, she never heard of postal banking, I guess, and public banking. And so I've been making a big issue of this during the campaign.
Oh, that's great. And I guess Bernie Sanders has expressed support for postal banking, right? I mean, I haven't heard him say it lately, but do you know what his...
I don't. I know that Senator Elizabeth Warren has been supporting postal banking. I wasn't sure about Bernie Sanders. You know, it's been hard on my own campaign to keep up with latest developments and other campaigns.
Yeah, I ran for state treasurer in California, which is not nearly as big of a campaign as yours in terms of funding and so forth. And, but I know what you mean. It's like way more overwhelming than you anticipate.
Absolutely. I'm constantly on the campaign trail, and we're getting a lot of support from working families. We've gotten endorsements now from some big unions, some big national unions, the Communication Workers of America and National Nurses United and the International Longshoremen's Union. And we've got a whole bunch of local unions, a local transport workers union that represents about 2,500 workers at Miami International Airport. The pipefitters and a bunch of other unions, I think, are about to line up to endorse us as well.
One thing I'm writing a book about, is how we could fund infrastructure without debt, basically, by tapping up the Federal Reserve. And last December, there was finally an infrastructure bill that did get money from the Federal Reserve, but by cutting into the dividends that are being paid to the shareholders of the Federal Reserve. So what do you think? Is there hope of dipping in and, you know, sort of prying that door open and getting Federal Reserve money for infrastructure?
Well, if I'm elected, certainly there'll be a bigger hope to do that. I will say that I saw an article recently that the banks are now trying to make the argument that this was an unconstitutional taking of their private property for the federal government to start dipping into this subsidy, basically, as if they've got a constitutional entitlement to the subsidy.
Right. It's not constitutional. It's the Federal Reserve Act, right, which is legislation which the Congress can change. They made it. They can change it, right?
That's right. Absolutely. And, you know, there are other aspects of the Federal Reserve System that I would argue are unconstitutional, you know, dealing with the governance structure of the Fed. But that argument, while I think it has merit, it's always been dismissed at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals level on procedural grounds, not on the merits. But the courts have said that private citizens don't have standing to bring these challenges.
But, yeah, so that would be marvelous. When you get elected, that would be great, that you actually have a voice on these things, yeah.
Yeah, it's an exciting campaign. Wasserman Schultz is also a drug warrior. She opposed medical marijuana in 2014 when it was on the ballot in Florida. I supported medical marijuana. It's going to be back on the ballot this year. She's called marijuana a gateway drug. She's been supporting private prisons, taking money from private prison companies and from big alcohol companies. So she's out of step with her constituents. In fact, when this medical marijuana referendum failed in Florida 2 years ago, it got 58% of the vote statewide. It's just that it needed 60% to pass. And in our district here, Florida's 23rd congressional district, this is probably the bluest district in the entire state, close to 70% of voters voted for medical marijuana. So there's a whole range of issues that it's clear she's out of step with her constituents, and it's an exciting time. You see it really at the presidential level with the momentum of really both Bernie Sanders' campaign and Donald Trump's, that there's a real anti-incumbent mood in the electorate. You saw it 2 years ago when an unknown professor defeated Eric Cantor, the second-ranking Republican in the House of Representatives in a Republican primary. So we've got a growing movement here, and it's very exciting to be part of it.
Yeah, I agree. We have a populist movement going, or a people's movement going in many places, in many ways. People are totally fed up. I mean, it was good that after 2008, first we let the banks play their thing out, you know, they got bailed out, supposedly, then they would bail us out. But now people are seeing that didn't happen. And so they don't believe big bank lobbyists anymore, and they don't believe the candidates that are supported by the big bank lobbyists.
And I'll tell you, just a couple of other issues that have resonated and that sort of inspired me to jump into this. One was the Trans-Pacific Partnership. My opponent, the only Democrat in Florida's House delegation to vote to fast-track the agreement. And it's an awful agreement for many of the reasons that you know well and you've written about. A number of other issues that have been resonating, I'd say across the board, I'd call it a jobs crisis. You know, folks look at the 5% unemployment rate, and it's laughable. It's just not, it doesn't reflect reality. And I've seen this teaching at law school. You know, I've been a professor for almost 20 years, and not just the school I'm at now, but universities across the country when I visit. I see that this generation is graduating quite often deeply in debt, paying high interest rates, with really lousy job opportunities. And they really want a new deal. And establishment politicians like Wasserman Schultz are really doing nothing about this. They don't consider it a crisis at all.
Yeah, I think it's really great that you've jumped in to, you know, actually do something about it. I mean, we writers, yeah, I know you're a writer too, but it's kind of, you feel like it's kind of futile. You just keep writing and writing. But to actually, I think you'll get elected and to actually get in there and be able to play the game with the, you know, have real influence is marvelous. And you've got such a great memory. And, I mean, you know, you can spit these things out off the top of your head like professors do. So you'll be great in there, I think.
I hope the rules of the game start changing. And that's what I'm hoping this campaign will start doing. If progressives around the country can start raising money the way I am through small donations, this is really the closest we have to a publicly financed election, I think, is the kind of campaign I'm running. And that's exactly what we need to break the power of these special interests.
Yeah, that's really inspiring, really, really a hopeful thought. And so my hat's off to you.
Well, thanks. And any of your listeners who want to either donate or see where I stand on the issues, they can go to our website, which is timcanova.com. You know, it's all right there. And we've got lots of folks volunteering for us all over the country who are phone banking for us, making calls into our district. So it's really, truly a great grassroots movement.
Okay, that's very exciting, and I'm really glad to have gotten a chance to talk to you.
Well, thanks for having me on, Ellen.
Okay, good luck.
Thanks. Take care.
Now we head west to speak with another candidate running for office with a strong commitment to monetary reform, Pamela Powers Hanley, who's running for the Arizona State House of Representatives from the Tucson area. Pam has been an advocate of public banking for years. She serves as the vice chair of the Public Banking Institute and is co-chair of Arizonans for a New Economy, which is a statewide group promoting development of public banks at the state and city and county levels. Pam just retired from being managing editor of the American Journal of Medicine, and her campaign runs against the common political wisdom of not getting into the weeds of talking about monetary policy. But she says the effects of the economic decline in Arizona make it an inescapable topic for its residents. In a recent presentation to a regional body of the Unitarian Universalists, Pam told them about the history and importance of the public banking movement going back 100 years.
The Unitarian Universalists have been very supportive of public banking. Our group, Arizona's for a New Economy, got connected with the Mountain Vista UU Church a few years ago, and they were looking for a way to save the middle class, basically. And so they wanted a group that they could connect with that would bring systemic change. And they found us, Arizona's for a New Economy. So their idea is, by backing public banking, is that it's a long-term solution to fix the financial system in the United States and help the middle class and raise people out of poverty. So they're coming at it from not necessarily the business angle, although it can be a pro-business tactic, but from the social justice angle. It's a nonpartisan message. Public banking in Arizona, at least, has been proposed as many times by Democrats as it has by Republicans, and it's definitely an issue that crosses party lines and crosses platforms because people can see how it benefits so many sectors of the economy.
And what does that look like in Arizona? What does the economic horizon look like there that makes this appealing?
Well, first of all, the Arizona legislature has been controlled by the Koch brothers, basically, for several years now. So they have been having year after year of budget cuts and austerity measures for the 99% and largesse for the 1%. They're giving away corporate tax cuts hand over fist. And even when we didn't have the money, they were still doing it. And so right now, the debt service has risen dramatically with austerity, because on the local level, there's more bond issues and things like that to try to make ends meet. Arizona's for a New Economy, we're trying to put the brakes on that and say, wait, there's other things that we could be doing. We can foster new businesses and small businesses in Arizona with public banking rather than throwing away money in corporate tax cuts that are primarily going to companies not headquartered in Arizona. So we're throwing it over the border, basically. And then in the meantime, the state has $312 million a year in interest that they're paying on our debt, and that keeps going up. So we're really trying to beat the drums of public banking to convince people that there's a better way to do things rather than taking on more risk and more debt.
You said in your speech that that the state paying above $1 billion a year in interest, and that your total debt service has risen by almost 100% in only 7 years. What was that driven by?
Yeah, the $1 billion figure came from if we added Arizona's interest plus Tucson plus Pima County plus Maricopa County, which is where Phoenix is, and that's where most of the people are. So you add up all those cities and counties plus the state, and it's an enormous amount of money. And it's like no wonder the cities and the counties in particular are starved. The state has stopped some of the revenue sharing with the cities and counties, and so then they've had to go to we've got multiple sales tax proposals on the table here in Tucson. And we're just like, hey, stop this. You know, we don't have to do it this way. But yes, definitely they're giving away way too much money, and they're laying too many people off. And, you know, so it's just that it's the whole austerity package is what we've got. But one of the things that we're working on right now is that I'm actually running for the legislature representing LD9, which is in Tucson, to try to bring stronger public banking advocate into the legislature. And by campaigning on economic reform, eliminating those tax cuts, or at least taking a look at them, and adding in public banking, people are really excited about that message because they see it as a different way to do business. Right now, we're doing more of the same and expecting different results, and we're not getting different results.
Actually, when you go back 100 years, you see another similar development. And that was another part of your speech, which was about the Nonpartisan League. Tell us a little bit about what those dynamics were and how that worked.
What's interesting is, you know, in this particular presidential election cycle, we've heard a lot about too big to fail banks and politicians on the take and bad trade deals like the TPP and things like that. And we've also heard about starting a revolution to save the middle class. And what happened in North Dakota in the early 1900s was they had very similar conditions. The farmers were under attack. They had high fees that they were paying to the railroads. And if they didn't keep up with their fees or their loan payments, the Wall Street banks foreclosed upon them. And we have almost exactly the same situation going on in Arizona on the border with Wall Street banks pulling accounts from growers, you know, farmers along the border who have been doing business on both sides of the Mexican border for years or for generations. And so in North Dakota in 1915, this obviously didn't sit well with the farmers because one family farm after another was being foreclosed upon and people were losing their livelihoods. And so these two guys got together, A.C. Townley, who was a failed flax farmer, and his friend Fred Wood, and they sat down at Fred's kitchen table one night and wrote up a plan for action to change the state of North Dakota. And so they had a really aggressive, very progressive platform, which included regulating the railroad fees and forming cooperatives and also forming the first public bank in the United States, which would have been the Bank of North Dakota. What was interesting was that they used just basic grassroots organizing, and Townley drove all over the North Dakota with a Nonpartisan League sign on his Model T and recruited farmers. And their dues were $6, and they called themselves the $6 suckers because they said, we're too dumb to quit, because they knew they were in a David and Goliath match. It was the Gilded Age, you know, and so they were up against the banks and the railroads. But, you know, long story short, they did have a revolution. They took over the legislature. They got the governorship, and they got one congressman, all people who were devoted to the ideals of the Nonpartisan League. One thing that was really brilliant was that they not only organized the farmers, but they organized the farm wives. And it was amazing because, you know, a farm wife living in North Dakota in 1915 would have been incredibly isolated. They had luncheons for these women. And if you look at the photos, they look like my grandma. They have their little print dresses on, their little hats and little pocketbooks, and there's like 50 or 60 of them in a room having lunch and learning about politics and hearing about the ideas of the Nonpartisan League. And it worked. They gave the women the right to vote before the rest of the country, and they had a revolution by organizing the farmers and the farm wives. And I think that one brilliant strategy they had was their slogan, especially for the women, was vote for the family, not for the party. So they told the women, when you're thinking about a candidate, think, what's that person going to do for my family? And if you apply that to what's going on today, you know, like in the Arizona legislature, we had a knockdown, drag-out battle about no more cuts to public education and about funding health insurance for poor children. So if a politician is not going to fund public education, is that good for the family? No, you know, so it's like, oh, I shouldn't vote for that because public education is actually good for my family, right? And also, if you look at the idea of would a politician who is going to not deny health coverage for poor children, is that a family-oriented person? No. So it was an interesting strategy. It got them away from thinking about Democrat or Republican or progressive or libertarian and thinking about who would work for my family in the legislature. And I think it's a great angle, you know, and it fits right in with public banking and the idea of saving the middle class. I think the people are actually ahead of the politicians at this point.
Well, that wouldn't be the first time. Well, we are watching your progress very attentively, and we'll wish you well, Pam.
I was just going to say one more thing about the Nonpartisan League. You know, people who live in states like Arizona, where we are really oppressed by the government. You know, we have government against the people is what I usually say, because of all these laws that help the 1% but not the rest of us. And when I talk about the Nonpartisan League, people see that here's a story that gives them hope. These farmers, they didn't have social media and they didn't have the internet. They had a Model T and a couple of guys with good ideas. So they see that they were able to organize and take over the legislature, and it gives them hope that we could take over the legislature someday and have more progressive politics back here in Arizona. It's heartwarming for the rest of us to say, okay, if they did it, we can do it.
Well, thank you very much, Pam.
Okay, well, thank you, Walt.
That's Pamela Powers Hanley, running for a seat in the Arizona State Legislature from Tucson. Now we check in on what Wall Street costs America, the Public Banking Institute's national project and campaign to expose the true costs of our reliance on Wall Street financing of our lives and communities. Today, Matt Standard talks with noted reporter and author David Dayan about how a few citizens in Florida took on the big banks and mortgage fraud and won.
David Dayan has a new book out. It has already been praised by Matt Taibbi and others as a groundbreaking story of the struggle of ordinary citizens against the forces of finance capital. David is a contributing writer to Salon, a weekly columnist for the Fiscal Times, and he writes for publications including The New Republic, The American Prospect, Guardian, Vice, The Intercept, and HuffPost. Chain of Title is the title of the book, and it is a book about how, during the Great Recession, a nurse, a car dealership worker, and a forensic expert helped uncover mortgage fraud, the nature of which had been massively perpetrated on the public by Wall Street. The book is just being released now, but it's already won awards. So, David, how does it feel to have won the Studs and Ida Terkel Award for the book?
Well, thank you. It's quite humbling as someone who did live briefly in Chicago when Studs Terkel was alive. To be put in the same class as him is really humbling. It's Studs wrote for the New Press, and the New Press likes to encourage first-time authors by especially ones that reflect Studs' interest in the human condition by giving them, you know, resources and giving them this award. And the last person to win it was actually Aaron Swartz, and then me. So it's doubly humbling in that respect.
Wall Street benefits greatly from this narrative that the mortgage crisis is our fault, or the fault of irresponsible borrowers. Do you see that kind of victim blaming across the entire financial industry?
Yes, without question. That was a key hurdle that my main characters had to traverse in this particular narrative. They were called deadbeats. They were told that they were just trying to get free houses on a technicality. They were told that they should just give up and submit to the industry, give up their homes. These were three foreclosure victims that decided to fight their own cases, which is very rare. 95% roughly of all foreclosure cases go uncontested. And I think a lot of the reason is the shame and humiliation that you just described that is, you know, has sort of been beaten into us by the financial industry. And so it's definitely inspiring to see people really rise up and contest these. And what they uncovered when they were in the midst of that is this massive scandal that everything that Wall Street was trying to do with regards to foreclosure was a lie.
So it's the Great Recession. We're in the midst of this huge mortgage crisis. And who are Lisa, Michael, and Lynn? In terms of, I mean, the premise of this is that we can fight back. Ordinary people can fight back. Who are they, and how did they do it?
Sure. So these were three individuals in South Florida. They all live around the West Palm Beach area. And they were foreclosure victims for whatever reason. There were millions of us that were caught up in the foreclosure crisis, whether we were sold loans that we couldn't afford, or we were just residual damage once the economic crisis hit and people lost their jobs or contracted medical bills or whatever it was to have their finances be strained. And their stories kind of mirror that. And they were people who committed a revolutionary act. They actually read the documents that they were given when they were summoned in their foreclosure cases. In Florida, you need a judicial sign-off for foreclosure. Mm-hmm. And so they were sued to be removed from their homes. And when they looked at the documents, they realized that these are fraudulent. They're backdated. They're forged. They're fabricated. People are signing their names when, in the case of Lynn Simone, I actually found out that one of the witnesses on her mortgage document was actually in state prison at the time that the document was executed. And so that raised some alarm bells. And it was basically those kinds of things that led them not just to work on their own cases, but to dig into the public records and discover patterns that this was not something that was happening in isolation to just these three people. It was systemic. And they really figured that out by really painstaking research, going into the public records. And then they found each other, and they made a pact to expose this to the entire nation. And I follow that story and tell that story.
And what enabled Wall Street to game the system and hurt so many people in the ways that are described, particularly since presumably someone can do a close reading of the documents and realize that they're illegitimate? So what made it so easy to do it otherwise?
Well, number one, the fact that virtually nobody can test their cases. Number two, the fact that foreclosure law was such a backwater that even some of the judges didn't know the ins and outs of what to look for. Certainly there was not really a foreclosure defense community in terms of the legal community for the simple reason that if people had enough money to go up against the biggest banks in America, they probably wouldn't be in foreclosure. So it was you didn't have a lot of defendants, and so you didn't have a lot of education about how to really fight these things in court. So those are some of the main reasons. And then the final reason is, even if you had all that, even if you had an educated defense and you did the close read and you looked at these things, the judges were conflicted by whether or not they should protect the integrity of their courtrooms if it meant giving someone, in their view, a free house, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
This, you know, judges and the mortgage industry, that's a closer kind of togetherness in terms of their social class rather than judges and troubled foreclosure victims, troubled borrowers. And I think there was a psychological angle that they really needed to break through in order for judges to, you know, do their duty, to uphold the law, to say that we're not going to allow false evidence to be used in these cases to evict people from their homes. And that was surprisingly hard to do.
Why do you think it was so hard to do, or why do you think the culture is so maybe ensconced in that direction?
Yeah, we've just been sold this idea that if you missed a payment on your mortgage, that there's something inherently wrong with you, that this culture of the deadbeat, this idea that debt is a moral failing, that you cannot break free of that stigma, there's really a conditional problem. And what's interesting is that my main characters sort of believe that themselves in the beginning. Lisa Epstein was someone who never missed a payment on anything in her entire life. She got thrust mm-hmm. into a situation where she sort of had a mortgage on a condo, sold that or tried to sell that condo, and bought a house at the same time at the wrong time when the market was crashing. And so she was paying on two separate properties at the same time. And so she knew she couldn't keep that up. And she had never missed a payment in her life. When she did, actually, she was told to miss three payments, and that's the only way she could get a loan modification
mm-hmm,
from her
mm-hmm.
mortgage servicer. And when she did, she told me she threw up every day for 3 months. That it was just, it meant being a bad person to miss a mortgage payment. And then, when, of course, she finally did what she was told, and for 3 months missed her mortgage payments. When she came back to that company and said, okay, now I'm looking to get a modification, they put her into foreclosure. So, you know, I think there is sort of a mentality in this country that if you miss a mortgage payment, something's wrong with you. However, there's no mentality in this country that if you systematically falsify and forge documents by the millions falsify evidence to be used in court cases to take people's homes away, somehow there's no stigma around that. And part of the purpose of me writing this book is to, you know, really put out what was done by these companies in during the crisis, and how it's absolutely just a horrendous action. It's the largest consumer fraud in American history, in my view.
And what other things might people learn, even serendipitously, reading the book? What surprised you when you were writing the book, whether it was on point to the subject matter or just incidental?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, one thing I've always been interested in is sort of the nature of how, you know, whistleblowers or people who operate in the public interest become sort of obsessed with this concept of bringing out justice. So it's interesting to watch these characters evolve, how they sacrifice everything in their lives. They two of them, their marriages break up. Two of them lose jobs. They subsist on practically nothing, and they just, you know, are insistent that they're going to find and expose the solution. And the interesting thing is, while they were so cynical about the mortgage industry and the banks and what they were doing, they had this sort of cockeyed, naive belief that if all they had to do is get this evidence in the hands of the right authority figure, and that they would come up with a reasonable solution for everybody. So there was this dichotomy between this extreme cynicism to believe this true story of what these banks perpetrated, and then this naivete that all you have to do is find the right guy in the Justice Department and it'll be all fixed. So that was surprising. And just that, you know, these guys did what the civics books in high school or junior high school tell us is what you do to sort of uncover an injustice and affect change. They did everything from finding the evidence, building a coalition, going through the protocols, telling the authority figures. And the fact that that didn't work suggests that there's something kind of broken. I mean, I'm not ruining the ending by telling you that nobody went to jail for any of this conduct practically, and there was no real punishment given. Why did that not happen? So that's really the question that we have to ask ourselves as a country, and it's one of the reasons why I wrote the book.
The book is Chain of Title. It's a story about how three ordinary people fought back against Wall Street, specifically against mortgage fraud. The author is David Dayan. Thank you so much, David, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Matt and David. This story is just one part of a series of reports that our project, What Wall Street Costs America, is generating that looks at the many ways Wall Street profiteers impact the lives and prospects of the American economy and culture. This project builds on the principle that the web of debt controlled by private interests that prioritize profits over everything continue to extract our commonwealth at an unsustainable and destructive pace. What Wall Street Costs America is a collaborative project, and we invite your participation by submitting stories, whether they're written, audio, or video, to be part of a national aggregation of data and narratives that will be featured on the What Wall Street Costs America website, where you'll find similar stories from around the country on a national map. You can find out how to participate and to contribute to the effort by going to our initial online site within publicbankinginstitute.org. You can also participate in our CrowdRise fundraising campaign by going to crowdrise.org and looking for What Wall Street Costs America. Our final website should be posted in the near future. You'll hear more stories like the one we just talked about on the coming editions of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. And if you'd like to offer some stories from your world for inclusion in this section of the show, please drop me a line at walt@publicbankinginstitute.org. The project is just getting underway, so we look forward to hearing from you. And by the way, the project is designed to get your community actively involved in taking steps to get free from Wall Street's web of debt. We invite you to find out more. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.